This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. The nonprofit organization We're All a Little Crazy was founded by former sports executive Eric Cusin to focus on changing the global conversation through mental health advocacy. Let's head to Manhattan and meet Eric Cusin on Sports Jam. We're All a Little Crazy, the Global Mental Health Alliance. It's something that Eric Cusin started in 2017. And Eric has quite a story to tell. And why is he on Sports Jam? Well, he's got an amazing connection to sports through the years. Not only has he held various positions with the NBA, with the New Jersey Devils, with the Phoenix Sun and Mercury, and also with the Florida Panthers. He works with athletes, he works with entertainers, and he has a great story to tell here on Sports Jam, and we're here in New York City to talk to Eric Cusin. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
Let's talk a little bit about mental health is where you're zeroing in on, and it all happened to you many, many years ago when you eventually found out that you had PTSD.
Yeah.
And it was something that you had no idea that you had, and it was something that even the people you work for were military people at the Florida Panthers, and they weren't even aware of it. We'll catch people up on your story here, but sure. Tell us a little bit about the organization itself and why this is so passionate for you without giving us all the details of the background.
Yeah, absolutely. I think because I went through my own story of challenge and struggle and then came to find out what it was in my prior life experiences that had caused those struggles, I started to take a look at what it was that we were getting communicated to through our messages in school, our messages through the media, our messages through nonprofits in this space. And there was a disconnect. There's a reason why we don't proactively work on our mental health, and then people end up in places like I did. So as I was making the decision as I got better, like you mentioned, we'll get into the story, I was making a decision on whether or not to go back into sports because that's all I knew for my entire career, or to go down this path. And when I saw such a large white space, I guess you call it, in the business side of things, right? You see people across the map doing things on this grid. The white space that existed in mental health was, at least how I saw it, exactly what needed to be done to change around the perception of what people think about mental health, and that the messages that are currently out there to try and do that right now are actually moving us further away from getting away from this thing called stigma that everyone talks about. So because I went through it, because it pulls on my heartstrings, because people started reaching out to me when I shared my story, it felt like the right calling is the best way I could describe it. So, you know, spirituality, religion, whatever people out there believe in, to me, it just felt like this happened to me for a reason. And now maybe I could use my sports relationships to help get this message out there on a larger platform.
You want to make clear that these life challenges that we all have affect all of us, and all of us face mental health issues. I've heard you talk about, no, it's not a 1 in 5 situation. These facts, they get in the way. They get in the way of how everybody this impacts, having to have a strong mental health attitude, outlook. And so breaking down these stigmas is always difficult, but you're doing it in such a fascinating way because you've also connected with some terrific athletes who are so anxious to tell their stories about their issues. Yep. You know, like Amanda Beer, the Olympic swimmer, yep. Theo Fleury, the terrific hockey player, even played just a few blocks down here at Madison Square Garden when he spent some time with the Rangers. For you, you kind of were headed on a path that was going to give you your dream job. You wanted to be an executive, a high executive in the sports world, and you were right on the cusp of that when you were with the Florida Panthers. And then something happened. Take us to that point.
Sure. So I had taken advantage of those opportunities that you had mentioned working for the NBA. One team we didn't mention there, I'll give them a little bit of love, is the Chicago Sky, a WNBA team on the way up. And the position that I was in with the Florida Panthers, the title was Chief Revenue Officer. And the only reason why that's relevant is because it's one step away from CEO, right? It's when you mentioned my dream job, I wanted to run a sports organization. And so when I started to experience symptoms, now I'll describe them to you, at first the way that they manifested was I was losing interest in things outside of the office. So didn't want to go on dates, didn't want to go to the gym, didn't have energy when I came home from work. Mind felt cloudy, right? And I justified that way I think many people in this world do, by saying, well, maybe this is the world's way of telling me I need to focus even more on my job. As ridiculous as that sounds, all of us work hard. So instead of getting in at 7 in the morning and not taking lunch and working the whole day through, let's get in at 6:30 in the morning, right? Let's cut lunch from 15 minutes to 10 minutes, you know, like, and you think about the ridiculousness of that, but at the time it made sense to me. Oh, okay, this must be a message that's getting sent to me in some way. And so that excuse only lasted about 2 weeks, because I woke up one morning and I had to push myself out of bed like I was in quicksand. I walked over to my closet, which we don't get to do in here in New York City. We don't have the room, but walked over to my closet in Florida, and it felt like I had cinder blocks on my feet. I remember looking in the closet and I couldn't decipher whether I should wear slacks or jeans or a t-shirt. Like, my mind wasn't processing. And then I was like, wait a second, should I take a shower first? Or, and these things that we take for granted that are just part of our daily routines, they were escaping me. I looked at, this was the real epiphany for me at home. I looked at the picture of my two nieces, who are the most important people in the world to me. I couldn't remember their middle names. Okay, this was me. And you say, well, why does that even come up? Because you're testing yourself when your brain's not working to see, what can I remember? What can I do? Because it feels like I don't have my faculties about me. I forced myself in the office that day, because that's what we do. We put on the smiley face. Not about stigma in this case, more about trying to prove to myself that I could still function and that this wasn't really happening. And I remember I went into the office that day, and again, I never took lunch, but I was behind my desk, and my desk had a wall window overlooking the rest of the employees. And there were people coming into the office, what felt like Grand Central Station, but really wasn't that active. It just felt like that in my mind. And my computer screen felt like light brights from back in the day, right? And I couldn't focus, couldn't concentrate. And so at lunchtime, I got in my car and I drove for 20 minutes. I was able to do the math. Okay, if I drive as far as I can for 20 minutes, find a parking lot, recline the seat, hopefully I'll sleep for 20 minutes. That will allow me to wake up and this will all go away, because I'll rest, because maybe it's just extra rest that I need. And then I'll have 20 minutes to get back to the office. No one will question an hour being away. Well, I come back and it's just as bad. And it feels like literally the earth is falling out from underneath me. And we had a game that night, and I would challenge our reps to have prospects in the suites, because you always want to introduce new fans and new corporate partners to the team. And usually you give an impassioned speech because it's something you do every day in the suite when the prospects are there. And I started getting nervous before the prospects were coming in, because I literally, this might sound hyperbolic, I couldn't think to what I was going to say to this group. Nothing was coming to mind. And I actually wrote down an index card. Hi, my name is Eric Hughes, and I'm the chief revenue officer here with the Florida Panthers. It's great to meet you. And that's all I could come up with. I read that, and then I just introduced Matt Caldwell, who was our CEO at the time, and I left the suite. I couldn't be around people. And I found my owner, and I found Matt, you know, and Matt has a military background as well, so that's where their affiliation is from. Vinny Viola, who had just purchased the team when we had been hired 6 months prior. And Vinny looked at me in the eyes and says, we never leave a soldier out in the battlefield. Whatever you're going through, whether it takes 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, come back, hit the ground running. And when I heard 3 months, I think this is an important part of the story for listeners, is because we don't get mental education in school, or at least hadn't at that point, right? Growing up in the 80s, 90s, even the 2000s, starting to slightly happen now, but it's still not required in all states, is that I learned about mental health from what I saw on commercials on TV. So I saw a person who was a cartoon character with a sad face and a gray cloud above their head, all of a sudden take a pill with beautiful music coming on, and then it became a blue sky and birds were singing and the sun was shining and they were smiling. And so my thought was, well, if I go home and I take these things called antidepressants, well, an antidepressant sounds like an antibiotic, right? You're going against something that's working poorly in your body, or working against your body. So that should probably work the same way that an antibiotic does, where you take this pill and it makes you better. And I wish that was the case, right? Because again, seeing that, and that's the commercials, that's what you think. And that led to, which, you know, we'll go into more detail on, essentially laying in bed for 2.5 years waiting for combinations of magic pills to kick in and get me better. I didn't watch TV because I didn't have interest. I didn't listen to the radio because I didn't have interest. I barely ate. I was not ashamed to admit this, living in my parents' house from where I grew up in a twin bed at my size. because I had no other place to go. I was not a functional human being for those 2.5 years.
And Eric, this is where your story gets very scary.
I was then recommended to do what's called TMS therapy, transcranial magnetic stimulation, where the idea is if they shoot electromagnetic waves into your brain, it'll wake your brain up. The synapses will start firing again. And you're told you have to do it every single day. It was not covered by insurance, so $350 a session, so any savings I had, say goodbye to. And a minimum of around 20 to 30 treatments. So I get up to treatment 23. I remember it because of the Jordan connection, obviously. And on the 23rd day, I come home and I can't fall asleep that night. So we decide I'm not going to go in the next day. The doctor says, it's okay, you don't have to come in. Next night, again, I don't fall asleep. So now I'm going on 2 nights of no sleep. So that following morning, I remember I'm looking at a bottle of pills on my counter, and my mind all of a sudden just, it was like a switch went off. And all I could think was this thought over and over again, swallow that bottle, swallow that bottle, swallow that bottle. Now, mind you, I'd never thought about swallowing a bottle of pills before. Nothing sad had gone on in my life in the last 2.5 years. So we think about suicide in this society, and we think someone broke up with their girlfriend, someone's dog died, and they're sad, so they're killing themselves because of it. That's not the case. There's a buildup of stress and trauma, which we'll talk about my past and when we talk about my situation with my brother and my friends. But trauma and stress that we live through builds up in our system, and it changes our system. In my case, the suicidal ideations, right? We are wired for survival of the fittest. We're wired to survive, to get food, shelter, and water. That system can break, just like a leg can break, just like a joint can break. We can tear a ligament. And so for me, that was my brain break. That's the way that I describe it. And for people, I'm tangentially going a little off because I think it's an important message. For people that we lose to suicide, the Tyler Helinskys of the world, because we're talking on a sports show where you didn't see the signs before, how are we not educating kids on what suicidal ideations are? We all have these thoughts in our head. When you're on the top of a building, your mind thinks, oh, it's a long drop down there. It's in there already. We don't focus on it the way that my mind focused on the bottle of pills. We're on a train platform. And we think, what happens if I stuck my leg out as a train comes by? We're driving in the center lane in a highway. And we think, what happens if my car turns to the left and the other car turns to the left? On a bridge, what happens if I turn my car to the right and it goes over the side of the bridge? These things are in our minds already because we're creative beings. We walk by a door. We think, what's behind that door? When the system breaks, what I believe happens is those thoughts happen on repeat in our mind. So to not teach people what it feels like for those thoughts to hack your brain, and to not teach what we've developed right now, an acronym called Lifesaver, where you actually teach people what to do, simple things that you would think are so elementary, but when you're in that moment of just dire circumstances, you don't know to sit still in the same spot, to not move, right? Because your mind is taking you, let's say, to a train, to train tracks. Like, it's taking you to these places. It feels like a magnetic pull. So for me, that was the impetus that got me to ask my parents to take me to a hospital. And I came to Cornell Med here in the city. Maybe it's not the best idea that I'm mentioning the name of a hospital when I give the rest of the story, but I was transferred to their Westchester facility, skipping a lot of details right now of how awful the psych ward experience is. I met with the attending psychiatrist, and she looked at my chart, and she said something to me that I never want a patient ever to hear again. Doesn't matter if it's mental or physical health. She looked me in the eyes, and she said, Eric, you've tried everything. This is your last resort. You must do shock therapy. And so when people hear that story, they think that I'm referring to shock therapy when I say, I don't want anyone to ever hear that again. I don't think a patient should ever be told this is your last resort. If we're willing to fight, and there's so many other alternative treatments, I can't even believe they're called alternative because some of them have been around for a lot longer than the more current treatments. But to be told this is the last thing that you have to try and that you're putting all your eggs in that basket, you're defeated if it doesn't work. And so I did the 12 sessions over 5 weeks of shock therapy, was the only one on my psych ward unit getting shock therapy at the time. So I had no one to compare it with, and left the hospital feeling no better after those 5 weeks. Again, not even going into the detail of how miserable the shock treatments are, and came home thinking my life is over unless Merck or Pfizer invents some miracle pill that does help me, whereas these other pills, 50 plus that I've taken for the last 2.5 years, haven't worked.
This is an extremely critical time in your life, and this is when your parents and you came together and made a decision that changed the life of Eric Hewson for the better.
my parents are both retired school teachers. My father, a principal, my mother, a language teacher. And so they go to these continuing education courses all the time. And so this woman was teaching a course on what was called integrative breathing practices. My parents are not very into like holistic-y type of stuff, but it was one of their friends who brought them. And the woman just happened to say, I treat people who deal with chronic pain and mental health complications very broadly. So my mom ran up to her after the class and said, these breathing practices that you're talking about and that you showed us, do they actually help people with mental health? My son's been told that he has, this was a term that they had all used, treatment-resistant depression. That's all I've been told. Because it's funny, because when you introduced it, you said, you know, PTSD, usually that doesn't come out until later in the story for this reason, because for 2.5 years, treatment-resistant depression, you're treatment-resistant. And so the woman says she'll meet with me, and I go meet with her, and instead of what had happened on all these other doctor visits that I had gone to for the 2.5 years prior, where the first question was, Eric, please tell us what your symptoms are. Okay, here's how we can help those symptoms. Her first question very broadly to me was, Eric, tell me about your life. And not like, let's dive into the relationship with your parents. Let's psychoanalyze that. It was just, tell me about your life. And now bringing it back to sports again, I just went to what I know. I'm the middle of three boys. We're a sports crazed family. Okay, you're the middle of three boys. Tell me about your older brother. And I give you the line of questioning because it's so important to share, because I didn't think to bring this piece up first. She brings this piece up, say, okay, well, let's start with your older brother. So this plays off in my mind like a bullet point list, just because this was life for me. I didn't know any different. So from the time I was 9 years old and he was 13, he first broke his femur bone in a sports accident, was in a body cast for a year, homeschooled. Heals from that. A lot of people get into accidents. I think most of us can relate to that. A month after coming back from that injury, is diagnosed with ALL, children's form of leukemia. Back then, chemo and radiation was not what it is today, and still not perfected by any means, but it ravaged his body, and it took a lot longer for it to administer to get the cancer out of his system. So 5 years of chemo and radiation and doctor's visits. Heals from that, goes into remission. You know, I say heals, remission, obviously. And he's driving on the Meadowbrook Parkway to an Islander game. It's interesting how it all comes back to sports. His friend's in an open Jeep Wrangler, doing what kids do, trying to, you know, impress the other cars behind him. No seatbelts in the back then, because we're talking about the 90s. My brother flies out of the back of the Jeep. And he lands on his head on the parkway, cracks his head open, loses partial vision in his eye, is in ICU for a month. Heals from that, goes to college, feels a pain in his knee. They do all the sports medicine testing, nothing wrong. He wasn't an athlete, but they figured pain, it might be related to that. They take more blood tests, the leukemia has come back. So now that the leukemia has come back, they have to give him a stronger chemo regimen. The stronger chemo regimen sends his body into septic shock. So he wakes up one morning, he's got 105 fever, bring him to the hospital. The septic shock is when your organs are literally attacking themselves, and his body goes into a coma. And now we're talking about late 90s. So I'm in college going back and forth to go see him as he's laying in this bed and these machines are breathing for him. The neurologists were not able to tell us anything, especially back then. I mean, it's still very hard when someone's under a coma. You don't know how they're going to. So for 3 months, we didn't know if he would be like that the rest of his life. Would he have any capabilities about him? Well, miraculously, he wakes and he does have his full faculties about him. But his kidneys failed while he was, you know, in the midst of the septic shock, and he needed to go on dialysis. Goes on dialysis. They test us all to see who's the closest match. My father ends up being the closest. And so my father donates a kidney to him. And I finally think, you know, we're in the clear. Everything's good. And the course of the next year, after this all happened, my brother, three of my close friends pass away from heart conditions. And so when I explain the story to the woman who I was talking to, Donna, you know, her jaw's on the floor, and I see the way that you're reacting as a, you know, a story that you kind of know a little, but you're also reacting to it, is she jumped at me. She said, Eric, you have PTSD. And I said, PTSD? I said, we hear that PTSD is for servicemen and women. That's what we learned in school. She said, no, Eric. She's like, the cognitive dysfunction that you're describing when you've been laying in the bed for so long is it not usually as severe as what you described, but people who've been through 9/11, were in the building, or their friends were in the building, who have lived through a natural disaster or seen friends die in a natural disaster, women who've been in the sex slave trade, the way that you're describing, the way that you're functioning is very similar to all these people who I see in these states. And so my brain, all of a sudden, this was my first epiphany in terms of this change of the way that we think about mental health. I just shot back at her and I said, wait, you're telling me that what I saw in my brother and my friends is what caused me to be this way? if we can get caused to be this way by things that we see happen to other people, not even to us, I'm not the one laying in the bed, I'm not the one flying out of the Jeep, then who in this world doesn't have a mental health complication? Because we all deal with things like job loss, breakups, divorces, bullying, cyberbullying, sexual abuse, verbal abuse. And that's just the beginning of the list. I mean, I remember saying to her the number, I could think of 200 things that people go through that they watch in other people that they love. And so she kind of gave me that sage type of smile and said, Eric, I believe that too. Unfortunately, our society doesn't believe that, but let's take care of you and get you better before you start worrying about other people. So she sent me to this weekend breathing course called The Art of Living, where, because she's such a big believer in breathing, I show up, I'm wearing my basketball jerseys type of shirt, you know, like a cut sleeve t-shirt and basketball shorts, and it's me and 8 Indian women and 9 yoga mats. So I'm a fish out of water. But I love learning the science behind things, and I love asking questions. And so the entire time that I'm there, what I'm doing is I'm asking why we're doing these breathing practices. And this wouldn't be the way that they would explain it, but this would be the best way I could take the learnings that I took from them and that I try to help explain to other people is, you and I sitting in this room right now, if a car lost control and burst through one of these walls, it would be one of the most shocking, surprising things for us, because a car coming through a wall in an office building, what? And we'd make this sound, right? We would stop breathing for a second. Well, when we face traumatic and stressful experiences in life, think about the son who's got a mother or the daughter who's got a mother who is facing cancer, right? And is going through treatments. And the kids are worrying about, am I ever going to see my mom again if she dies? What happens after she dies? Is she going to live through this, right? All the what if questions. A person at work who's not having a great relationship with their boss, am I going to get let go? What essentially all these people are doing is they're doing over and over and over again. And so the science that I learned is there's a nerve that's the largest nerve in our body called the vagus nerve that goes from the base kind of our brain, right, kind of the top of the neck, all the way into our stomach. And it makes sense that our bodies develop this way because the way that we breathe, based on the stimulus around us, is going to tell that nerve how to communicate with the rest of the body. And so when we're constantly expecting the worst, which is what I was doing, because I kept getting these calls over the course of my life that something had happened. Well, I'm not breathing properly. Even though, yes, I'm running on the basketball court and I'm playing games and those things are keeping me, you know, not distracted. Really, at the end of the day, my nature was to think something bad was happening and to not breathe properly. So by doing breathing practices every day, essentially what I'm doing is I'm helping that vagus nerve to say, everything's okay. You're going to be all right. Bad things are going to happen, and you'll react when those bad things happen, but it doesn't mean you have to brace for those bad things to happen all the time. And the reason we get caught in these freeze modes, that they call it, right, fight, flight, freeze, is because when for so long we've been expecting the worst, your body can't handle all of that, the expectations of something bad happening and preparing for that and still doing your day-to-day, every single day stuff. Talking about athletes, right, and I'll continue with the story, but I think athletes have a tremendous way to explain their experiences and how it's similar to the rest of us, because what athletes do is they're patted on the back their whole lives, being told, be the first one on the field, be the last one off. You're here to win championships. You're here to be the best athlete, be the best teammate. So what happens is when they are playing their sport, they're getting that dopamine hit. They're thinking things are great. They're thinking they're doing what's healthy for their whole body. Guess what? They're carrying a bag of emotional baggage that, just like we are, but because they're doing what they think they love, if they're not dealing with the emotional baggage they're holding on to, that stuff eventually surfaces. And that's what happened with me. My equivalent of sports when I graduated was working in the sports industry. I loved doing the business side of sports. So I didn't focus on these other things, didn't think that they mattered to me, and that's what ultimately knocked me on my butt. So what it led to was after I did the breathing practice, I did it for 30 days straight after the session was over. They asked us to do it for 40, but this happened to me on the 30th day, and I still do them every day now. As I woke up one morning, it was like a light switch went on, and I all of a sudden looked at my TV, and I was like, what's going to be on TV today? And I looked at, you know, a plate of what I had eaten on before, thinking I'd rather have scrambled eggs for breakfast instead of pancakes, right? It was like things that we take for granted that come to us naturally, but they felt like game 7 of my team's, you know, favorite team's playoff series, because I hadn't been able to feel those things for so long. And so I decided I was going to share my story, and this talk about, again, epiphanies and the changes, what makes you go to do these things. I had some friends not too far from here who had an ad agency office in New York City, and they invited me to come in to do some mental gymnastics and to get my mind going. And I said, you know, I just feel a need to share my story. Didn't have Instagram, didn't have Twitter. And I was one of those voyeurs, they call it, on Facebook and LinkedIn, where I just watch what everyone else does and I don't really post. And I wrote my story up like on a Word document like that. And I think it was like 8 pages. It would take 35 minutes to read. And my friends being digital marketers, don't put it up there. Like, no one's going to read that.
They were wrong.
Right. Exactly. Right. And but, you know, I call this either the best decision or the worst decision of my life, that I put on that post my telephone number, my personal telephone number, because my thought was, I have 2,000 people in the sports world I'm connected with, 200 people will get a fed to them, 20 people will read it, 10 people will respond to me, 5 people will call. Great. Well, 3 days, 150,000 reads in 3 days, and over 400 calls from as far as China. And I know the number was over 400 because I'm tracking them in an Excel spreadsheet and erasing my voicemails as they're coming in. So epiphany number two for me was this idea that everyone's going through something. The stories that people were sharing with me, complete strangers that I had never spoken with before, only because I opened up and shared my story, there wasn't a single mention of disorder on these calls. Now, that might be because it was people who avoided going to therapy and didn't want the diagnosis label, but hey, even case in point, even more, they were saying to me things like, Eric, I lost a child to SIDS 5 years ago and I've never been the same, okay? Awful, awful thing. All the way to, and I'll give you the other end of the spectrum, I had a woman, 32 years old, call me and said, I've been married for 4 or 5 years now. I have 2 beautiful kids, a great husband, white picket fence, and I wake up every day wondering if I made the wrong decision with my college boyfriend that I broke up with him because I think about whether or not I should have been with him. So you think about this concept of stress and trauma, this concept of thinking about the what if, this concept of not breathing properly. Sometimes we do it to ourselves. Sometimes we overanalyze and overexamine. Sometimes it's the factors of life experiences that happen to us. But essentially, I just started piecing these things together like a puzzle in my mind. I'm saying the thread that ties this human experience together is that we all go through challenges. Those challenges, they're slightly unique to each of us, but there's similarities within them. We obsess over those challenges, some of us more than others. And that changes our system over time. This sounds very similar to what happens with our physical health, where our physical health changes over time, yet we proactively teach kids about jump rope for heart, right? And all these things at a young age. We take physical education every day in school, but yet we're not proactively working on our mental health. And we're telling people it's a 1 in 5 issue, back to your point earlier, and that it's only this thing that mental health is equated with mental illness. Well, what about the other 4 in 5 people? They're just going to wait. The equivalent in physical health would be like us saying, don't go to the general practitioner. Don't go on the treadmill. Don't eat well. And if you get this cancer or diabetes thing, we'll treat it then when it happens. Think about when you put it in that context, think about how ridiculous that sounds. And so that was what gave me the passion to decide to start this organization. The hardest thing was, do I give up on sports, which is what I worked so hard on? And I think, you know, you mentioned the names like Theo Fleury and people like that. The ability that I had to be one step away from getting in touch with these folks because of the relationships I had built working in sports, I was able to justify in my mind, maybe I went through this experience, maybe I worked in sports to be able to build these relationships so that I could help get this message on a larger platform.
You're listening to Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle, and my guest is Eric Cusin, the founder of We're All a Little Crazy, a nonprofit organization that is focused on changing the global conversation through mental health advocacy. Eric spent 15 years as a professional sports executive, but suffered from PTSD with so many traumatic things that happened around him and to his brother. Let's head back to New York City now and learn more about We're All a Little Crazy and Eric Cusin on Sports Jam.
I want to talk about the physical gesture, the sign language for same here, because that's a big thing for you, same here. And it really, in one, just like when you see photos of people who are working with you and everybody is giving the symbol, it really carries the message. It's happening to me. It can happen to you. We're all in this together. It's the perfect symbol for what you're talking about.
I appreciate that you asked that question. And I'm going to pat you on the back for doing it because I probably get, you know, when we do these types of podcasts, I get, you know, the same type of questions over and over again. And it's usually at the end when someone says to me, do you want to share any additional information? And then we bring up the fact that you picked up on that. That to me is awesome that it clicks for you, right? And the thing is, it clicks for everyone else. But usually when I'm interviewed, the interviewer doesn't pick up on it because the story seems more fascinating to them than now what we're doing with it, right? And exactly to your point, you'll find the story fascinating. So the way that we created Same Here and the motion that you described, Theo was the first athlete, Theo Fleury, that I spoke with. And as if I had the right to ask Theo this question, I said, Theo, I want to make sure I'm working with the right person. Would you give up your favorite NHL goal to be able to save someone's life? And he said, Eric, without hesitation, he goes, I would give up my Olympic gold medal and my Stanley Cup ring just to change one person's life. He said, I played hockey so that I could have a platform to help people. You hear that and, like, you know, I'm sure you're getting goosebumps the way that I have goosebumps, right? And so I heard that, and then Theo continues to tell me stories. He said, Eric, let me tell you how I got into this space more. And he talks about how he wrote his book, Playing with Fire. And he said, there was a guy in the line when I did my first book signing for my first book. We're in a store in Toronto, 400 people lined up. And I'm thinking, what are 400 people doing? If I was playing hockey with them, okay, but to get a book signed? And he sees this guy, and as a lot of us obsess over, he sees this guy waiting in the back of the line. And he's inching towards him. The guy stands out because he's got a flat brim hat over his face. His clothes look ragged. He said he literally looked like a homeless person. Now, here's the fascinating thing, the timing of the story. Theo is telling me this story August of 2017, right when I started to feel a little bit better. This is before everything came out with Harvey Weinstein and that whole movement blew up. So Theo is telling me the story. He's thinking, what is this guy going to say to me when he comes up to me? Guy puts the book down in front of him, lifts his hat up, looks Theo in the eyes, and just very softly whispers to him, me too. Now, Theo's story, we know, is one of sexual abuse, right? And I wasn't thinking of it in terms of sexual abuse when Theo shared it with me, because that wasn't my experience. I was just thinking of it in terms of, wow, those two words, me too, speak thousands of words just within two words. And the connection that we have, I was like, that's really powerful. We have to do something with that, Theo. So I went to the American Sign Language website, because my thought was, if we're going to differentiate this and we're gonna actually show people something different than the current campaigns that are out there, so we can come together around this, because we're gonna be taking pictures, because we're gonna be doing so many events, we need a visual symbol of it. And when I saw that the sign for Me Too first in American Sign Language was your thumb pointed at your chest perpendicularly, three middle fingers curled like a fist, and your pinky pointed out at the other person. To your point, you're making this connection between us. We are going through same things. It doesn't mean that you're going through depression, I'm going through depression, you're going through anxiety, I'm going through anxiety. The broader scope is, you're going through challenges, I've gone through challenges. If we haven't chose those challenges and life hands them to us, what are we ashamed of talking about them for? They're stories, they're things that we live through. And so originally it was going to be Me Too. The Harvey Weinstein thing breaks. I call Theo up. This is not to joke about that movement because of how serious that movement is, but like, Theo, I don't know if we should go with this name anymore. It's now focused narrowly on this topic. He's like, totally get it. So I look for the synonym. And you think of serendipity of things, like Same Here was the synonym for Me Too. But we need to use Same Here in a much broader context, right, than just Me Too standing for sexual abuse, because that means it's a contained group of people who've been through that experience, whereas Same Here is about all the life challenges we all face. And the S became a great alliteration that the M probably wouldn't have worked with in so many things that we do. Same Here schools, Same Here sports, right? Same Here service for servicemen and women.
Same Here safe.
Yeah. Same Here safe for offices, exactly. And so you think about that and you say, did that happen for a reason? Like, you know, sometimes you pinch yourself at all these things, the way that they come about. And so, yeah, the symbol was always going to be that. We had to change the hashtag. And I'm happy. And I get very few people who say to me, Eric, that's so similar to Me Too. And the reason is, I think because of the hand sign that we use, is you're showing a whole group of people, all diverse backgrounds, men and women. Not that, totally to Theo's point, Me Too can happen to men, absolutely, and has happened to so many men. I think our society thinks of Me Too, and they primarily think of women, right? And so the challenge we have with Same Here is showing a diverse group of everyone. And so the first video we ever released was we sent an email out to friends that we had all over the world, like a group of us who were part of the initial launch of the nonprofit. And we explained this concept. Would you mind getting someone to take a picture in front of the Eiffel Tower, in front of the Sydney Opera House, in front of the wall in Jerusalem? And once people got it, we got pictures from all over. And our opening video that we created, that I still use to this day when we go around these programs, is these people with all different looks, all different backgrounds, all different ages, all different dresses, right? And they're all sharing that sign, and that shows the commonality. We are all one tribe at the end of the day. And I know that sounds like foofy and like, you know, a little cliche, but I'm not saying it from like a, you know, a cliche perspective. I'm saying it from a boots on the ground, hearing people's stories. It literally is what connects us, even more so than the happy times. And by the way, life is not all about the low times. There's low times and there's happy times. And that's what makes life beautiful, the contrast between those two things. But I think we connect more when we show vulnerability than when we just show happiness.
And then we're in such a divisive world today that it's very impressive that you've been able to kind of break through that. We're speaking with Eric Cusin, and we're talking about, we're all a little crazy. And I want to talk about that word crazy, because you and I talked briefly before we started.
Yeah.
There are some mental health groups that have always said, don't use that word, when, especially to journalists and that, don't use that word. But you've been able to turn that word around and make it so much more impactful and in such a specific way that you're reaching more people by using that word than carrying on a stigma.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for explaining it that way and for asking the question. When we launched, I was trying to think of a word. You want something that's going to jar people a little bit and make them turn their heads and say, let me check that out. I've never seen that before. You also want to do something that's different than what's been done if the numbers are showing that our suicide rates are growing and that our mental health challenges that we're seeing in schools and beyond are growing. Well, that means we need to change the message. We need to be more inclusive. We need to get more people involved. And so the very, from a hierarchical perspective, it was mental health is on a continuum. It's 5 and 5. It's not 1 and 5. How can I get everyone to feel like they're all part of the same group? And so crazy in a literal sense is absolutely a stigmatizing word. There's no question. As someone who has a diagnosable, quote, mental illness, right, of PTSD, who knows what it's like to feel the literal sense of the word crazy, I totally get how some people will be triggered in a way by that. We're very careful with the way that we use crazy. There's quotes around that anytime we use it as a word, you know, a set of words. In the logo, the A is upside down to show the approachability of it. So what we're doing is we're actually poking fun at the word normal by saying we're all a little crazy. And what we can do there is we can take this word that we use in everyday language. We were discussing a little bit before is I might say to you, Doug, this sandwich tastes crazy good. Doug, you're acting a little crazy today. These are things that we use in everyday language that because we use it in everyday language, it appeals to more people. And I might have an organization that says to me, Eric, you're triggering people who are sick. My answer to them would be, how many people are we leaving behind in the 4 and 5 that we're not getting through to when we hear stories of you never would have thought with that person? We talked about Tyler Helinski, right? These people that we're losing, these beautiful individuals in some cases, or these people who are struggling in some cases, every life is important. But we're not, the message isn't getting through to them. We can't get them to join on our team because they don't like with all due respect to the organizations that don't like the term crazy, I don't like the term mental illness. So let's meet in the middle somewhere, right? Let's find that happy ground. And so to me, crazy being the only word in the English language, at least, that can speak to something that is meant in a tongue-in-cheek way, that people can almost wear it a prideful way, like, yeah, that makes me unique and that makes me myself, but also can speak to, yeah, but maybe there's some things I should look into here with that make me that person that I am right now. And it gets people at least hooked in. And I can tell you the one place we've stayed with that brand more than anything from the beginning has been Facebook. And we don't do ad campaigns and stuff like that, right? We just have our names up there. And Facebook, we 2 years, but do nothing, 55,000 followers, right? Is the name draws people in and they look at it. And then once you've drawn them in, now this conversation that we just had for the last 20 minutes, 30 minutes, I can start to have those conversations with those people. But if I come in and I call our organization Mental Health Awareness Organization, right? No disrespect to some of the other ones that are out there, but let's be honest, it's a very, very vanilla way of saying it. You're only going to appeal to a certain group of people who've already been diagnosed, or I call the Future Psychologists of America group, the people who are really passionate about this topic. Well, what about the rest of society? does mental health not matter to them? Do we not lose people that way? So it's meant to try and bring as many people together as we can.
I want to talk about your family, because that's where a lot of the stigmas, and people don't want to say, hey, my son is struggling or my daughter has issues. I would imagine that your family is so proud of Eric Hewson right now.
It's funny you say that. So, you know, I know you love stories. So my mom wasn't very happy that I went out with my story. My dad kind of sat back a little bit, and I think he saw what I was doing and wanted to wait to see what the reaction was. I come from a family where it's private matters stay private within the family. Not so much like don't talk to each other. Talking to each other is fine. Other people don't know, need to know what we've been through. And my initial first reaction to that was like, my brother went through all these things pretty publicly in front of everyone in our town. Do you not know that like we have a history of things happening? And then when things happen, they affect us. That's my whole message here. So why are we being quiet? If anything, we should use what we learned from that to help people. And my mom is the most giving person in the world. I would say that. So it wasn't that my mom wasn't giving. Is that I think my mom was raised in a generation where it's not someone else's right to know what's going on privately with us, but also are we burdening someone else with our stuff when we share it with them? And so I remember I shared the story without, you know, her blessing on LinkedIn. And the first person to then share it after it had gone viral on LinkedIn was Darren Revelle from ESPN. And I remember it coming home, and I didn't know much about like social numbers and stuff like that until now this started happening, because I didn't have Twitter back then. And I remember looking at Darren's Twitter handle and seeing that he had 2 million followers. So I said to my mom, I said, you know, I think this story will really be able to help a lot of people. Darren Revelle has got 2 million followers, tweeted this story out. And she goes, he had no right to do that. And I think that's such a motherly thing, protective thing to say, right? I said, what do you mean he had no right? He asked me if it was okay, and I told him it was okay. And so, yeah, I think they're beaming with pride now because they come to these events like they did with the Dwight Gooden event that we had last night, which we can talk about, is they see the impact that my story can have on helping other people. And when they see how people react in the audience, when they see people come up to me or to Doc or whoever I bring with me after an event and literally start pouring their own heart out and saying this is what they've been through, that's what gives them pride, is that I'm helping people, right? Now, they don't understand business. They don't understand the growth of an organization. They don't get the bigger picture. They're teachers, and that's no disrespect, and they're two of the smartest people I've ever met, but like, if you try to lay out on a vision board where we're going with this, they would have no concept of it. Wait, is it with school? Are you doing a school thing? I don't get it. Why are you going to offices once and then schools another time? So I think more intellectually, they understand that it's a story that helps people, and that's all they need to know about it, and they're happy about that, so they come and support it for that reason.
And you think about it, that's really all they need to know about it, is that you're helping someone. And you talked about how Theo Fleury would give up his Stanley Cup ring to change somebody's life. When you think about now, you look at your career, there are so many people that I think would give up a lot if they knew they could save a life. We've heard people say that.
Yep.
Who has been the person that's touched you the most, that's reached out to you, and you've changed their life?
Oh, you know, I had this story the other day. I'll share a couple, actually. I mean, the stories are abound, right? Because every time you go and present to a college, to a school. So the other day, we did one of our first presentations, because it's still a new thing to younger elementary school kids. I'm talking about like first grade through fifth grade. And they had the floor that they were sitting on was called their gymatorium, right? So it's an auditorium that made out of a gym. So there's no chairs. They're all sitting on the floor. And I'm thinking, I have to explain this concept of we all go through something. We're all in this together a little bit differently to these kids than I do to high school students and above. And so the way that I broke it down was I shared my story in a more, you know, simplistic way. And I explained to them that those were my challenges that I faced. They were challenges in my life. And then I gave them a list so that they could see in front of them. And I gave them a sheet of paper that had the same here hand in the middle, name with a line underneath so they could write their name. And then there were four circles around the same here hand. And I said, it could be one challenge, it could be two, it could be three, it could be four. You could go beyond that circle if you want. And by the way, you don't have to share with me. But what I want you to do is think about my story. You're all a lot younger than I am. And I showed a picture of myself at their age, right, being an elementary school kid. And I said, I was like you one day, and I remember the challenges that I was facing at that young of an age, even before all this stuff started happening with my brother. I want you guys to write. You could keep it to yourself if you like, the challenges that you face. And so, you know, this in the audience, and I told them that they have 5 minutes to write it down. They all have pencils that the teachers handed out. I said, okay. I said, look, if no one wants to share, that's fine. And these are 500 kids, first or fifth grade. But is there anyone that does want to share? And all of a sudden, hands start shooting up one after the other. So I go up to the first kid. I'm making up his name now, so for privacy purposes. What's your name? Timmy? Okay, Timmy, what do you want to share? Three of my pets passed away this year, and I'm really sad because they were really important to me. He shares this. 300 of the 500 kids, I'm obviously approximating here, jump up with their hands up in the air, say, my pets passed away too. I'm sad for my pets. And we did that three more times. It was someone who shared that their aunt was sick. It was someone who shared that they moved to a new town, that this was a new town for them. And each time someone shared, the other kids were jumping up and saying, essentially, same here, just using their own language, me too, or I'm the same, or I went through that also. And what you realize is there's this common fabric that we have as humans that we want to connect, that after we turn to fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth grade, now we're middle schoolers, now we have this thing called ego, now we don't want to share the things. Look, what I'm pointing the finger is the same thing that my mom was sharing with me. People don't need to know that stuff, right? But I think we're wired for connection, and that experience with those kids showed that. So that's kind of a broad area example. I had another college student came up to me, right? And this, from a heartstring perspective, maybe this one doesn't pull on it as much, but I think this is a really interesting play on how everyone has a very different perspective. So do the whole sessions. The sessions usually last about 2 hours, and then I wait after people want to come up and talk. And so this girl's been waiting online. I should say woman, young woman in college. And she comes up to me, she says, Eric, good. And like there's a tear coming down her eye. She's like, you didn't ask for those things to happen to you. And I didn't know if she was asking in the form of a question and a statement. And so first I thought she was, you know, almost comforting me. Like, hey, Eric, like, I'm really sorry you went through this. Maybe that's a little egocentric for me to think that. Like, I was like, oh, thank you for saying that. She's like, no, but you didn't choose these things. Then it clicked for me. She was asking for herself. She just didn't know how to ask it. The things that I, this young woman, have been through, does that mean I haven't chosen those bad things to happen to me either? So somewhere along the way, and I don't know her family history, and it's not my place to ask. I'm not a therapist, and I'm not someone who deserves that knowledge unless she wants to open up and share. But somewhere along the way, she developed this idea that bad things happen because of anything that she's done. It could be guilt trip related. It could be her own obsessional thinking from reading a book that formed this idea. But she's thinking that if someone in the family passes away or her dad loses the job, it's because she did something and now this bad thing happened to her. And to be able to be relieved of that stress and to watch this girl go from crying to now being bright-eyed and feeling like the weight of the world had gone off her shoulders, that to me, that's why I do this stuff, you know, is because to be able to get through to people and to realize that everyone is dealing with something, but those some things are different to each of us in our own unique way, and it's our perspective of how we view the world. I would never even have thought that someone thought that these things happen to us and that they're our fault for happening to them. And this opened up a whole new perspective for me for the way in which I present with people. So hopefully those two stories are a good representation of kind of the breadth of the type of stuff that happens when we meet with people.
You've been inviting people to tell stories since you started this organization. Going to your website, one of the things I love about it is Eric's not about Eric. Eric is about helping people, and you will see that he has direct links to all different types of therapies and different types of treatments that are all natural. You have nutritionists, yoga, you have all kinds of things that people can try, and it's all natural, and it's all a way of just help. Here's another thing that may help you, and you're sharing it with the world. You're not holding it back and saying, I have the magic solution and come to me because I'm the one.
$15.99 a month.
Exactly. You're not doing that.
I appreciate you pointing that out. I mean, I'm a little uncomfortable even that on the About Us page, it starts with me, and I had to be convinced of that because what was shared with me, and I took this feedback to heart, was, yes, it's about the brand. It's about We're All a Little Crazy. It's about Same Here in our campaign. It's about getting out this important message. At the same time, the organizations that seem to do the best in terms of getting that message across to people also have a personality behind it that at least shares their journey along the way, right? Howard Schultz with a Starbucks, not trying to compare ourselves to Starbucks in any way, but more in terms of seeing the success of people. And I think a lot of organizations, the CEO or the head of the organization takes a step back. Sometimes they're too forward, right? Sometimes they're too all about them. So for me, it was, I had to get a little bit in this uncomfortable role. I was saying I didn't have social media before, so I had to create a social account. I had to create Twitter and Instagram. I called those accounts at first, We're All a Little Crazy, now Same Here Global. But I called them that because, to your point, I didn't want it to be about me. I used my voice and my narrative to show people vulnerabilities. The text that I showed you before we started this about someone asking me if I struggle as well. Now, she hadn't read my prior post. She was just coming to our page for the first time. And so when we're having an event with Dwight Gooden, it seems like a career highlight, right? To be able to have this awesome icon of an athlete that I grew up idolizing, though, as a Yankee fan, right? And he did play for the Yankees. That makes sense also. But, you know, he's known for the Mets. Is that I didn't want this event to be about Eric got Dwight. And I almost feel comfortable when I put it on like my own Facebook pages to spread a message. I always try to share at these events, here's what we learned at this event. Here's what the takeaway. Here's what Dwight shared that was different than what was in his story that's on our website. And then people write me, they're like, Eric, you're killing it. Keep going. You're doing a great job. It's very appreciate. I appreciate that people do it. But it makes me uncomfortable in a way because I feel like I was given this gift of a struggle, as weird as that friggin' sounds. And there's a graphic that a designer created for us that is just, she's genius, this woman, she's out of New Zealand. And she shows like me on a car, on a career path, and it shows the different spots that you were mentioning, the suns, the devils, et cetera. And then it shows a crash, and then the road takes a different turn, and then it shows a We're All a Little Crazy logo and the Same Here logo. And so I feel like I was lucky, as weird as that sounds, because the 2.5 years, don't get me wrong, were the most miserable 2.5 years I could ever imagine anyone living through. I would, every bone I've broken in my body, I would take 10 times over versus that feeling that I had for all 2.5 years of that period. But what it gave me is it gave me this platform. It gave me this opportunity to do this. It gave me this story, right? And you combine it with that, and now I'm saying, I want to start an organization that helps people. You know what? And there's a monetary piece to this that eventually I have to be, selfish is the wrong term, but let's be, you know, the real answer is probably like frugally and fiscally responsible, right? Where when we are doing curriculum for schools like we have right now, I want to make it available for the lowest possible cost. So it's scalable, so any school can have it. So by the way, I can take that money, reinvest it, and give it to lower income schools that can't afford that curriculum, and they're getting it on behalf of some of the schools that can afford it, right? Things like that. And I'm not, you know, I think people, mine might spin different ways in terms of where my politics are and things like that. All I'm saying is that I believe that we're given tools and we're given stories, and then it's our responsibility. And it's our joy, not only our responsibility, and Dwight mentioned this when he was speaking, you get so much out of giving. That's more valuable to me than any money I could ever make. And so you won't see from us like putting out things, you know, being like, let's monetize this and let me get an investor. So many people have approached me and said, you've got an incredible brand here that you're building. You've got incredible people behind it from a public-facing perspective. What VC company are you speaking to? And I said, that hasn't even crossed my mind, because maybe I am the literal sense of crazy that I believe this. I believe the brand is so strong, and I believe the people behind it are so genuine that I think organically this thing is going to grow the way it's been growing on its own. And the only reason I would ever take VC money is if it helped get the message out there, not because I want to monetize this in some $1 million way or something like that.
Aaron Cusin chose the road less traveled by, and it really has made all the difference for him when it comes to pro sports business consultant, talking with athletes, entertainers, practitioners. Everybody is being challenged in some way, and that's his message. And you also talked about the need to mandate mental health curriculum, and that it's not in every state, and that's something that you want to do. Now, you had mentioned Doc Gooden, and he was a part just recently of a screening of a Ben Affleck film that or Ben plays the lead character, a basketball coach, in The Way Back.
We need a new coach, Jack. You're the first person I thought of.
Is the team any good?
No.
In fact, the last time they made the playoffs, back when you were playing.
It's the whole team, 10 kids. You want to know why they're leaving you open? It's because they don't think you could hit the ocean from the beach. Oh, snap.
Heard you're coaching basketball.
Keeps my mind off other things.
I just want you to be happy again. But you gotta want it too.
Don't underestimate the impact you can have on them.
You got this. No, don't just nod. I want to hear your voice. Yes or no?
Yes, coach.
You're nervous. I get it. Truth is, they're more talented than you. Probably got a better coach. But I promise you, they are not a better team. Because they haven't been through what we've been through. They don't know adversity. They don't know what it's like to get knocked down, to have to get back up again. They don't know what it is to fight.
Who are we?
Why are you connected with that film?
So through a contact that we both know, he had been seeing the work that we were doing. He was working with Warner Brothers on helping them on the promotion of this film. And it ended up being the perfect fit because the film itself, you think it's like a Hoosiers film when you first see the clips of it, the highlight reels. I'm forgetting the name of the what they call when you the sizzle reel, I guess.
The trailer.
The trailer. There we go. See, this is how well-versed I am in the movie world. So you see the trailer and you think it's going to be about him being carried off as the winning coach. I don't want to give it away to people because they'll go and see it, but it's more about the challenging life experiences that this coach has faced and where it's taken him in terms of self-medication, where it's taken him in terms of challenges that were connected to those initial challenges in life and that built from there, and then how he seeks out help for those challenges. And so because the movie is not about just sports, one, because the movie is not on the complete other end of the spectrum about this thing called mental illness, there's no disorders mentioned in it, nothing like that. Because it's about life and the way that life kind of got to this guy, that the character Jack that Ben plays, it was the perfect fit for us to be able to say, let's take the stories of the different personalities. And in this case, you know, I think we shared, this is not an athlete-only organization. It's for everyone. But in this case, we have a network of athletes. It's one of our networks. Let's go to different markets and do screenings with this movie because the theme of the movie fits so well with the stories of what all these athletes are sharing. And I think in Dwight's case, you know, getting him here in New York, he's got his own comeback story because most of us would look at Dwight and think, young guy who got too famous too quickly, partied too hard, and got into drugs and alcohol and ruined his life, right? Well, most people don't know that Dwight Gooden's sister was shot in the head when he was a young kid. He was just 5 years old. He was holding his baby nephew when he watched the shooting take place. And then Dwight tried cocaine for the first time when he was 19 years old, not at a party, at home with his cousin. And he said the feeling that he got when he tried the cocaine for the first time was, oh my God, I didn't realize how much weight of the world I had been carrying on my shoulders and how much that had been bogging me down. I feel like I'm released of that pain. Not I'm loving this high. That was not his reaction. His reaction was this boulder that I've been carrying seems like it's been dropped. That's self-medication when you think about it. And so now your brain gets used to that, right? And now you think that's the because we're not taught the mental health education in school, like you mentioned. So no one's getting, especially in the 80s, no one's getting in Dwight's ear being like, here's yoga, meditation, mindfulness, and breathing practices to do. And so we see these stories of these athletes, and they're such great microcosm for what the rest of us go through because they're playing out in a public stage that I just want to make sure the story is not, because we get reached out to all the time, the story in society should not be, look at these athletes. Athletes go through mental illness like everyone else. They're part of the 1 in 5 category. They themselves, and that's what our media is doing. We hear about celebrity stories, and every time there's a celebrity story, there's a label next to the name. this celebrity has this disorder, did this erratic behavior. Look at what just happened with Delonte West, right? They wanted to put bipolar as the reason why he's got his shirt off and why he's speaking erratically on the street. We don't hear anything about what's gone on with Delonte West prior to that in his life.
As we get to wrap up this edition of Sports Jam, you mentioned on your website that it's breathing exercises, yoga classes, EFT tapping, which, by the way, as I was before I came today, I was doing it with the guy right on the right on his website. Natural supplements, and when it comes to also a balanced diet, when people look at Eric Cusin, you look real healthy, Eric, and I would imagine that also is a great thing, because you're present, especially when you come to talk to kids. Yeah. You know, they see this big guy who played basketball, walk on it at Cornell, and went to JFK in Belmar, and was part of the Cougars, all the different sports that you were there. So they see this person, and yeah, it can happen to anybody, and it does impact everybody.
That to me is, you know, it's hard to like put a spotlight on yourself and say, how do people perceive you? It's a balance, because part of it is, I appreciate you saying that I look healthy. I mean, I'd like to believe that maybe it's because I don't have the wife and kids yet, which a lot of my friends give me a hard time about. That's why you look healthy. You know, the other piece of it is also being able to share, even in, okay, maybe I do look healthy, but hey, when I give a presentation and I'm on the road and I've been traveling, I'm locked in that bed and I'm knocked on my butt for 2 hours because I need to recoup to come back and I need to do my breathing practices. And this isn't just always smiley, always happy Eric. It's you're dealing with other stuff as well. So,
one last question. How often do you think about your friends that passed away?
Every day, because they were such important influences in my life, number one. Number two, I've had to stop myself a little bit because it's a little bit, you know, we're in an office of a friend who does CBT. Doing my own practices of not obsessing over what would happen if they were still with us. What would life look like? You know, one of my friends was married. His wife was pregnant at the time, 6 weeks only, when he passed. And the baby was born. I've been very much involved in their life. And, of course, it's hard for me not to think about what would it be like with him there as the father. So I think about them often. And but there's a balance, because you also have to move on in life as well. And so it's keeping their memory alive. It's speaking to them when your heart wants to speak to them, but also knowing you've got your own message you have to carve out as well.
We know that people are listening to Sports Jam right now are saying, yep, I'm in his shoes, or I can relate, because everybody can relate. How can they get a hold of your website? How can they get a hold of you?
Thank you. So I'll give the easier website to go to. Go to samehermovement.org. So S-A-M-E-H-E-R-E movement.org. Our social channels, probably the more popular ones, on Instagram and Twitter, it's samehere_global. So @samehere_global. And then Facebook, which is our largest community, is We Are All a Little Crazy. So between all those places, you know, mostly on the Same Here side of things, Facebook is a little bit different because we're attracting a more diverse audience. Would love to help people out. And we've got a community of people who are sharing their stories on a daily basis and then talking in the comments. So please come and join us.
I can only imagine how people at Belmar JFK and Cornell University, where you got your BS marketing and management degree, how proud they are of you, as well as all those pro sports organizations that have had you as part of their organization. You're doing amazing work, Eric. Eric Cusin has been our guest here on Sports Jam. Amazing just to be able to walk on to play college basketball. But he has taken a whole new path and is really making a difference and saving people's lives. Congratulations and continued success.
Thank you so much. And it was a pleasure talking with you. I really appreciate it.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the podcasts by going to WBGO.org/Sports Jam. Or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on the NPR list of podcasts. Special thanks going out this week to Joe Favorito for hooking us up with our guest. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.